No, of course not. I turned her to face me. Look, Jodie, you've met lots of new people since you've been with me, and none of them has hurt you. I wouldn't let them come here if I didn't think it was for the best. You do trust me, don't you? She nodded. Then please trust me on this, sweet. She let me dry her tears with a tissue, but I wasn't sure that she'd accepted my assurances. After all, her time with me had been relatively short compared with the 8 years beforehand. In Jodie's experience, my world was still the exception, not the norm. I read her a story and settled her for the night. As I came out of her room, I heard Amy telling Jodie,
"You can trust Kathy. Really, you can."
As the day of the visit drew nearer, Jodie became increasingly unstable. She lapsed in and out of the Reg and Amy characters, and in between she offered little else. Occasionally I saw the real Jodie, and I tried to make the most of it, but she quickly retreated back into her shell, and I was again met with that blank, unrelenting stare. School remained out of the question, and, apart from essential shopping expeditions, we hardly left the house. On the morning of Ron and Betty's visit, she was no different, and I was anxious that she'd deteriorate further with strangers coming into the house. Betty phoned from the car to say they'd be with us in 15 minutes, and I warned her of my concerns. "You've done well to see it through," she said, as positive and perceptive as her husband. "Once we're in the house and she's met us, it will become easier." I wasn't convinced. I returned to the lounge where I'd started a jigsaw in the hope of trying to entice Jodie into doing something. "That was Ron and Betty," I said brightly. "They'll be with us shortly. Shall we start this puzzle?" To my amazement, she slid off the sofa, picked a piece and passed it to me. I put it into position and the face of a cat took shape.
"Where's our cat?" she asked suddenly.
"Tosha's asleep in her basket by the radiator."
"Have they got a cat?"
"I don't know. That's something we could ask." She passed me another piece and I snapped it into place. When the doorbell rang, Jodie was still on the floor, to all appearances playing contentedly like any other child. I took Ron and Betty's coats and showed them into the lounge. They were a well-built couple in their late 40s, smartly dressed in country casuals with warm, likeable faces.
"Hi, Jodie," Betty said brightly. "It's very nice to meet you."
She bent down to examine the jigsaw.
"That's good. Do you like puzzles?"
Jodie nodded.
"This is my husband, Ron."
Jodie looked up and smiled as Ron sat unobtrusively in the armchair a short way from her.
"Jodie was wondering if you had a cat," I said. "Not a cat," replied Betty, "but behind the house is a field with lots of cows." "Cows?" said Jodie, suddenly interested.
"Yes. In the morning you can hear them mooing, and then the farmer comes and takes them for milking. The children love to watch that. Sometimes the cows come right up to the fence and you can stroke them."
"Really?"
She was beaming now. I slipped into the kitchen and made some coffee. Tosha, hearing new voices, rose languidly from her basket and went in to take a look. I heard Jodie introduce her.
"This is Tosha, but she's smaller than a cow."
"That's right," said Betty, "a lot smaller." Jodie must have seen something in Ron and Betty, because she was so unlike the child I'd described, I felt my account could have been called into question if there hadn't been all the other reports. I carried the tray through as Betty helped put the finishing touches to the jigsaw. I sat and admired the result. Jodie passed around the plate of biscuits, then sat beside Betty on the sofa.
"Tell me what other games you like, Jodie," said Ron, gently introducing himself into the conversation. He was softly spoken and could never have been described as intimidating.
"Painting, I like," she said, "and going to the park."
"That sounds good."
He smiled at her, and Jodie smiled back. We spent some minutes talking about the park, then Ron subtly drew the conversation to High Oaks and the activities and outings they did there.
He took a leaflet from his pocket. It was a children's version of the one I'd seen at the meeting, and we gathered around Jodie as we read through it. As Jodie turned the pages, Ron described their daily routine and mentioned some of the other children. Jodie asked if they had a television and what time they went to bed. Ron and Betty stayed for nearly 2 hours, talking and playing, and showed us a short video of High Oaks, which included the rooms and the grounds. Once they were satisfied that Jodie was ready, they suggested we make a date to visit High Oaks the following week.
"I want to go now!"
laughed Jodie, jumping up.
"Oh, no!" Betty smiled. "We want to have your room ready so you can see it when you come."
This was the first time any of us had mentioned her room or the possibility of her living there, and I watched Jodie to see her response.
"Can Kathy come?"
"For the visit, of course," replied Ron. "She'll bring you in the car, and you'll both see your room and meet everyone. Then the next time you come, you can stay the night, and Kathy will come home and pick you up the following day."
"Will I stroke a cow?"
she asked.
"You'll certainly see one," said Betty. "Whether you stroke it or not depends on how close it comes to the fence."
I smiled to myself. Cows had clearly replaced cats in Jodie's affections, as surely as Ron and Betty were replacing me. We saw them out and waved goodbye, and Jodie remained lively and excited for the rest of the afternoon. She spent some time painting in the conservatory, and when I came in to check on her, she grinned proudly as she showed me her latest work. It was a bright, colourful picture of a big red house set in a green field with 3 brown cows.
Chapter 31. High Oaks. A week later, there was an air of hushed expectation as we pulled into the drive at High Oaks and the imposing manor house came in view. Jodie had spent much of the long drive dozing or talking to Julie, her life-size doll. As we approached High Oaks, she fell silent and pulled herself forward for a better view. We recognised the house from the video, but I was surprised at its size close up. It was enormous, with 14 bedrooms stretching out over 2 wings and an annex to the right, which had once been the servants' quarters and was now the therapy and quiet room. The roof was gabled, dipping over an arched brick porch, which was draped with ivy. I guess the buildings had been built in the mid-19th century.
"This is very grand," I said.
"We'll have to make an appointment to speak to you." Jodie grinned, not quite understanding what I'd said, but appreciating that it was special and that it applied to her. I parked behind a line of 3 cars on the carriage drive and opened Jodie's door to let her out. She slipped her hand in mine and we crunched across the gravel towards the oak door. I pulled the brass bell cord and we heard the bell echo inside.
"Me do it," she said,
and gave it another 3 sharp tugs. The door opened and Betty appeared, smiling.
"Do you like our bell, Jodie? We thought about having a modern one fitted, but everyone voted to keep it."
Jodie immediately swapped my hand for Betty's, and I was surprised, as that morning she'd claimed she didn't even know who Betty was. We walked into the hall, which was decorated by white-painted panels with stencilled rosettes in the centre of each square, giving the space a light, cheery feel. Ron appeared from within the house.
"Hi, Jodie. Hi, Kathy. Did you have a good journey?"
"Yes, thank you,"
I answered for us both. Jodie took refuge behind Betty. Ron had phoned the previous evening, and I'd updated him on Jodie's state of mind. There had been no change, and Jodie hadn't raised the subject of the visit. We'd only discussed it once the day before, when I'd reminded Jodie that we were going, and Reg had replied that he fucking wasn't.
"This way to the lounge," said Betty, leading Jodie down the hall. "The children are out for a walk, which is why it's so quiet. They'll be back later."
The lounge was at the back of the house, and it must have been 3 times the size of ours at home. Through the French windows was a concrete patio area, and beyond that there were swings, a climbing frame, a seesaw, and a magnificent tree house.
Beyond the fence at the back, I could see the field, which was at present empty of cows. The lounge was furnished practically, with four sofas around the walls, as well as two armchairs and half a dozen beanbags, arranged at angles facing the widescreen television.
"We use this room in the evenings and weekends," Ron said, "when we're all together. We'll show you the rest of the house later."
Jody sat next to Betty on one of the sofas and propped her doll between them. I sat on the adjacent sofa and Ron took the large armchair. We were like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, with the father bear having the largest. Betty offered us a drink, but we declined, having stopped on the motorway for breakfast.
"We have 10 children with us at present," said Ron, looking at Jody, "and 9 carers to help. Claire and Val will be your special adults. You'll meet them next visit. Betty and I are always here, so is the housekeeper, Shirley. She makes our meals. Then we all help clear away. I know you like helping, don't you, Jody?"
She didn't answer, but smiled sheepishly and inched into Betty. Ron continued to explain how the children had turns in choosing what they wanted for the evening meal. Meanwhile, I glanced around the room. I wondered how they kept it so clean and tidy with so many children, and supposed it must be down to the housekeeper.
"Now, have you thought of any questions?" asked Ron.
"Where's the cows?"
she said, becoming more confident and wriggling to the edge of the sofa.
"At this time of day, they're usually in the upper fields. You'll be able to see them from your bedroom. Would you like to look round now?"
She nodded vigorously and slid off the sofa. With a dull clutch under her arm, she followed Betty into the dining room, which also overlooked the garden and had a long refectory table and 14 chairs. Next to this was the office, which the children were not allowed to go into without knocking first. Next door was the playroom, which was as big as the lounge and brimming with toys, beanbags and equipment. There were 3 computers, various small plastic tables and cupboards stacked with games, soft toys and books. There was also a home corner, which was equipped with a toy cooker, a sink, a microwave, a settee and a cot. Around one little table sat half a dozen teddy bears, with plastic cups and plates neatly laid out in front of them. Jody pointed at it excitedly.
"We had a teddy bear's picnic last night," said Betty.
"I bet your dolly would like to join in next time." Jody shook Julie so that the doll appeared to be nodding.
"Good, then we'll lay an extra place."
We moved on to the kitchen where a woman was busy at the sink.
"Shirley, this is Jody," Ron said, "and her carer, Kathy."
Shirley was a rotund woman in her late 50s with a kind, open face. She wiped her hands on her apron and came over.
"Hello, Jody. Nice to meet you. And who's this?"
She was referring to the doll, but Jody had hidden her behind Betty's back.
"I'm sorry," I said, shaking her hand. "No problem. I expect she'll show me next time."
Now, your bedroom," Betty said, sensing Jody's eagerness to move on. Jody released her hand and took mine, and we followed Ron up the winding staircase with an impressive balustrade, along the landing to the door second from last.
"You go in first, Jody," Betty encouraged. "This is your room and we're your guests."
Jody proudly turned the handle and went in, and we heard her gasp with delight. The room had been freshly decorated in two-tone peach, with complimentary flowered curtains and a matching duvet. A new pine bed was against one wall with a matching wardrobe, chest of drawers and bookcase against the other. Jody was at the window.
"Over there! I can see cows!"
I stood behind her as we looked out on half a dozen Frisians gathered around a massive oak tree to the right of the property.
"Cows at last!" I said, as much to Betty and Ron as to Jody.
But it was a beautiful view, with the ground stretching to the field on one side and rolling hills on the other. I couldn't have imagined a better start to Jody's recovery than opening the curtains every morning and gazing on such tranquility. She stood staring for a while, then turned to explore her room. She opened and closed all the drawers, investigated the wardrobe, and then sat heavily on the bed. Next time you come, Betty said, you can bring one of your toys and leave it in your room if you like.
I can leave the doll now, she exclaimed, holding her up by the arm.
Are you sure? If she's your favourite, you won't see her again until next week.
I want her to stay, she said determinedly.
Betty and I exchanged approving glances as Jody pulled back the duvet and tucked Julie in. Clearly, this was a positive sign. We moved on to the bathrooms, which were each shared by three children. We then walked past the other bedrooms, but we didn't go in. Betty explained to Jody that these were private. As we headed downstairs, the front door opened and the children returned from their walk. The quiet house suddenly erupted into excited chattering, and Jody grabbed my hand and froze.
It's okay, I said. There's nothing to worry about.
We'll say a quick hello, said Betty encouragingly. Then I think that's enough for today. You've done very well, Jody.
I coaxed her down the rest of the stairs, but confronted with so many new faces, she stayed hidden behind me. The children began taking off their muddy boots and hanging up their coats. They all had their own pegs and shoeboxes.
This is Jody and Kathy, Ron said.
There was a chorus of hi's and hellos, but Jody said nothing and stayed where she was.
Is the hot chocolate ready?
One boy asked.
Shirley's doing it now, replied Ron.
It seemed that a long walk followed by hot chocolate was a regular routine, and the children streamed off in the direction of the dining room like one big family returning from an outing. With the hall now clear, Jody came out from her hiding place.
Have you thought of any more questions? Betty smiled.
Jody shook her head and moved towards the front door.
Okay, well, if you do think of anything, you can tell Kathy. We'll give you a ring tomorrow and then see you next week.
I thanked them as we left, and they waved until we were out of sight. Jody, having risen to the occasion, was now physically and emotionally exhausted. She lay on the back seat moaning, then stuck her thumb in her mouth, curled into a ball, and was asleep within 5 minutes. I phoned home to say we were on our way and told the children the visit had gone well.
So she's definitely going, then?
Paula asked. I could hear the sadness in her voice.
Yes, you know, it really is the best place for her, and I think she knows that. I'll tell you all about it later.
I settled in the traffic on the southbound carriage at a steady 65 to 70 miles per hour. Every now and then I glanced in the mirror as Jody slept on the back seat. She'd been so calm and normal today. I was tempted to overlook the months of disturbed behaviour and believe once again that she could possibly have stayed with us. Maybe with regular therapy, love and patience, she could recover and learn to function within a family. In my mind, I replayed Dr. Burrow's diagnosis and wondered if she was ever wrong. Did she make mistakes? Was her conclusion 100% certain, or just the best guess she could make at the time? We were the only family Jody had, and however good High Oaks might have been, it was still a children's home. I turned Radio 4 on quietly and focused on the car in front. 20 minutes from home, Jody woke with a cry. She was desperate for the toilet.
I can't wait, Kathy. I'll wet myself.
This was at least one area where she clearly had improved. A year ago, she would have simply done it on the back seat. I pulled off the motorway and found a quiet lane. Then I spotted an entrance to a field. I pulled in and led Jody behind a clump of trees.
You can squat here. No one can see.
She lifted her skirt and grinned.
Do you want to watch?
No, of course not. I turned my back. I heard the stream of water, then her voice.
My daddy did. I had to pee on his face. He said it was the drink of the gods, warm and sweet.
I said nothing. Hiding my revulsion had become as much a part of caring for Jody as showing love and affection. Chapter 32. Overnight Stay. Jody's normality was short-lived, and it took all my energy to see her through the following days. The morning after the visit, she woke up expecting to see cows out of her bedroom window and became angry when I told her that they were at High Oaks and that she'd see them again the following week.
"You've taken them," she sneered. "It's your fault. You hate me."
"I don't hate you, Jodie. I like you very much."
"Give me the cows, then," she persisted. "I want them now."
"I can't, sweet. They're not here. It's impossible." I wondered if her confusion was due to the impending move. Bringing her to a realization that she would be going was a subtle and gradual process. I'd obviously never said, "You are going to leave us, Jodie," which would have made her feel rejected and negated the positive feelings about High Oaks that we had carefully been nurturing. Instead, we worked on bringing her to an understanding that she would be going to High Oaks in the near future, first for a visit where she would have her own room and stay the night and have lots of fun. It all had to be very positive, which it was. It was moving on, not leaving behind. She appeared to listen as I emphasized all the progress she had made during her stay with us and how much she would enjoy herself at High Oaks with Ron and Betty, how we would all miss her and that we would still visit.
"Will my mummy and daddy visit?" she asked.
"No, definitely not." But whereas in the past this would have given her some comfort, she now seemed to see it as another rejection.
"You lot! You're all the same! I hate you! Get out!"
Reg suddenly appeared and lunged at me, spitting abuse. I hurried out and shut the door, then hovered on the landing. 10 minutes later, the door swung open. Amy appeared with her thumb in her mouth and a wet stain down the front of her pyjamas. And it was a measure of how strange and distorted our lives had become that I was pleased to see Reg and Amy back. It meant that some level of normality had been regained. As the days brought us closer to Jodie's next visit to High Oaks, she flipped between acute lethargy and violent anger, so I was administering sympathy and discipline in equal amounts, sometimes within the same minute. I was also struggling to come to terms with my own feelings about her leaving, as well as having to try to keep the rest of the family's spirits up. I felt I was being stretched in all directions. Wednesday morning finally arrived, and we found ourselves at High Oaks again, this time with Jodie's overnight bag. Jodie rang the bell enthusiastically, and Ron and Betty answered. They'd advised me to keep my goodbye as short as possible, but in practice I was given no choice in the matter. Jodie wanted nothing to do with me, instantly transferring her affections and attention to Betty. "Bye then, Jodie," I said cheerfully. "Have a lovely time, and I'll see you tomorrow." She said nothing and met my offer of a kiss and a hug with sullen refusal. Betty gave me a sympathetic smile, as if to say, "Don't take it personally," but that didn't stop the pang of rejection I felt. Jodie and I had been together almost constantly for a year, and I felt that everything we'd been through had bonded us and brought us close. It was hard seeing her turn her back on me and walk away without a second thought. It was not her fault, I reminded myself. Her ability to form attachments was yet another piece of her personality numbed and stunted by the abuse. I was the normal one, not her, and I ought to be grateful to have the capacity to love and miss other people. On the way home, though, I had to stop for a strong black coffee and some quiet time to help me recover. By the time I arrived back, there wasn't much of the day left. I made dinner for the children, cleared up the plates, and then collapsed in front of the television. After a fitful night's sleep, I returned to Collector at 1 p.m. However, as much as our first visit had been a success, this one had not. Ron took me aside on the gravel drive and updated me. "She had a couple of tantrums, which weren't entirely unexpected. Betty had to restrain her once after she attacked one of the boys. But please don't worry, Kathy. This move is obviously going to cause a reaction. We're well prepared for it." Jodie was due to move there permanently in only 5 days' time, and I now had misgivings about the timetable. "Do you think we ought to consider pushing the move back to give her more time to adjust?" I asked. "No," he replied firmly.
In my experience, delaying it now would only confuse her and make it worse.
We stepped into the hall, and Betty and Jodie appeared from the playroom. Jodie wasn't happy.
What are you doing here?
She scowled.
Why do you always stop me having fun?
It's time to go home, Jodie, I replied patiently.
But I want to stay here. Why won't you let me stay?
The same old Jodie, with her unfathomable switcharounds and contrary behaviour. You can stay very soon, Jodie, but just not today, okay? Now come on, we have to get going. Ron and Betty saw her into the car with her bag. We were up most of the night. Jodie was scared and disoriented and adamant that there were people in her room. The next morning I was exhausted, but I was kept busy by a battery of phone calls from the various professionals involved with Jodie's case, all wanting updates and arranging their final visits. Sally, the guardian, came round to say goodbye. Her report was now complete, so her practical involvement with Jodie was over. As she explained this to Jodie, I could see that Sally had developed a genuine affection for her. I realised how difficult her job must be, always having to say goodbye. Jodie, however, couldn't remember who Sally was and told her to fuck off. Jill arrived the next morning and gave Jodie a present for her new bedroom. It was a pretty china ornament of a cat, and Jodie seemed pleased and even thanked her. Now that Jodie was leaving me, Jill would end her connection with the case, so she had wanted to come round and say a proper goodbye to Jodie. It was not only that she was a nice person, it's good social work practice to say goodbye to children when you are no longer going to see them. For a child who is constantly moving and meeting lots of new adults, it can be disorienting if people simply vanish from their lives with no explanation, and it can make them feel even more abandoned and out of control. So when children leave me, there are always visits and goodbyes and a little farewell party.
Goodbye then, Jodie, Jill said as she left. Lots of luck.
Say goodbye to Jill, I said, and Jodie obediently waved her off. However, as soon as Jill had gone, Jodie threw the china cat on the floor, smashing it into pieces. Dr. Burrows phoned that afternoon and said she would need to see Jodie one last time before filing her assessment in court. To my relief, she added that she would prefer to leave it until Jodie had relocated to Highoaks, so she could include this in her report. The final visitor, 2 days before the move, was Eileen, who breezed in more than an hour late, again offering no apology. In her case, it was not goodbye, as Eileen would continue being Jodie's social worker and should visit Jodie and monitor her progress. I felt a little sad that the only person who was going to stay in official contact with Jodie was the one who seemed to care least about her, but there was not much I could do about that.
"Are you looking forward to going?" she asked insensitively. "You'll be living with other boys and girls just like you."
"I'm going to kill them all,"
Jodie thundered, rising to the occasion.
"I'm going to rip their heads off, and yours, you bleeding cow."
Eileen declined my offer of coffee and was with us for just 15 minutes, as usual. It was probably the last time I was going to see Eileen. Another social worker might have continued the connection and kept me informed out of courtesy, but I had a feeling that wouldn't happen in this case, and I couldn't stifle a sense of relief that I wouldn't have to deal with her any more myself. I showed her to the door, and she turned round with a cheery and unconcerned, "Bye then." There were no words of thanks or gratitude for the hard work I'd put into Jodie over the past year, or any sense that we had been bonded by this tragic little girl. "Goodbye, Eileen," I said. If anyone had needed a damn good social worker, it was Jodie. But maybe, between the rest of us, Dr. Burrows, Sally, Jill and myself, we had done our best to make up for it. After Eileen left, it took me an hour to calm Jodie down again, and I promised her she wouldn't be seeing much more of Eileen. Given Eileen's performance to date, this was probably true. Despite Jodie's negative outbursts about Highoaks, she also said on more than one occasion that she wanted to go and live with the cows.
The following afternoon, I found her in the kitchen, trying to open the cupboard doors. "What are you looking for, Jodie?"
"Carrier bags,"
she muttered, as if it was none of my business. "Can you tell me why? I might be able to help."
"I need to pack,"
she answered wearily. I took her upstairs, fetched the suitcases from the top of my wardrobe, and carried them through to her room. We worked slowly, side by side.
"It's like going on holiday,"
she said, stuffing handfuls of toys into the holdalls.
"Yes, a little. Have you ever been on holiday, Jodie?"
She looked at me blankly, and I realised that, like many deprived children, she'd probably never had a proper holiday, but was simply repeating what she'd heard at school or on TV.
"This is more like moving home,"
I added, which was something she could relate to. I felt a pang of regret, for if things had been different, I could have taken her on her first holiday. During these last few days, Adrian, Paula and Lucy were unusually quiet and showed enduring patience in the face of Jodie's tantrums and insults. I knew that they, like me, were finding Jodie's departure more difficult than that of any other child we'd fostered. To say goodbye when a child is returning to parents who have overcome their problems has an optimistic feeling of success. Even those children who can't return home and have found adoptive families or long-term foster placements leave with a fresh start and the knowledge that they will be welcomed and loved by a new set of parents. The only consolation in Jodie's case was that she'd be in safe hands and would finally receive the therapy that I hoped would set her on the path to recovery. Chapter 33. Goodbye. On the morning of the move, Jodie refused breakfast and sat at the kitchen table, waiting impatiently. I finished my coffee, then began stacking her cases in the hall. She stood at the bottom of the stairs watching me, but turned her back when I asked her if she wanted to help. Eventually, all the bags were piled up in the hallway, just as they had been a year before.
"Where are we going?"
asked Jodie, trying to reach her coat. I lifted it down.
"To High Oaks, remember? You're going to your new home." "Oh, goody! Is it today? I thought it was next year."
Next year, next week, it was all the same to Jodie. Adrian, Lucy and Paula got up early so they could see us off before going to school. They gathered in the hallway, uncertain what to say. Paula took the lead and tried to give Jodie a hug, but she stuck out her tongue and turned sideways.
"We'll miss you, Jodie," Lucy said, "and we'll speak to you soon."
Jodie just shrugged. She seemed to be quite indifferent to the parting, even though it was obvious Paula and Lucy were quite upset. The three of them helped me load the car, then stood on the doorstep waving.
"You going home?"
asked Jodie as we pulled out of sight.
"I will be once I've settled you, yes." "Good. Don't want you. I've got Betty. You can go home, Kathy."
I knew this was her way of dealing with the separation. She was feeling an emotion, but couldn't acknowledge what it was, or even that she was feeling it.
"I'll phone you on Saturday," I said, "and when Betty and Ron tell me it's okay, we'll all come and visit." "Don't want to," she said again. "Hate you all."
She'd only been awake for an hour, but she was soon asleep again. She had been reasonably quiet in the night, but as I glanced back at her, lying on the back seat, I wondered how well she could have slept. I turned the radio on low, then switched it off again. The busy string quartet only added to my gloom. I concentrated on driving and reminded myself of all the positive aspects of where Jodie was going. Nonetheless, I kept returning to the guilty question that made me feel hollow inside. Had I really done all I could to help her? When we arrived at High Oaks, Jodie still had her eyes closed, but I sensed that she wasn't asleep. "Jodie, pet," I gently rocked her shoulder. "We're here. Shall we go and find Ron and Betty?" Her eyelids flickered, then opened, and she smiled directly at me. She gave me her hand and I helped her scramble out. Ron and Betty appeared on the doorstep, but Jodie dashed straight past them and up to her room. The three of us went inside and had coffee in the lounge. As it was a weekday, the children were having lessons in the playroom and I could hear the steady hum of their voices as we talked. We completed the paperwork and I handed over Jodie's bank book, where I'd been depositing £5 a week. The allowance from the social services that is supposed to cover pocket money and treats is minuscule, so I made it up with my own money to a half-decent sum to provide a little fund for the future. It was the only money of her own Jodie would have. I also handed over the book in which I'd kept a record of the things we had done and which I knew would be part of her life story work.
"This looks good,"
said Ron, flicking through the pages and seeing photographs of us all and the places we had been, pasted in drawings, bus tickets, train tickets, pamphlets and other memorabilia from days out. I'd written a few lines under each entry, with an explanation and the date.
"Great," he said. "This will really help with the life story work, and of course we'll be continuing it here as well. It's one of the best I've seen."
So many foster parents don't seem to have the time to do it, and it's so important for these children to have evidence of their past, particularly when they start therapy. Hopefully, Jodie's social worker will be able to give us some things as well, from the time before she came to you.
Don't count on it, I thought, but said nothing.
Ron smiled.
You've done magnificently for Jodie. You really have.
Thanks, Kathy. She couldn't have asked for better.
I welcomed Ron's praise. I already greatly admired the work he and Betty did at High Oaks, and a compliment from him was valued and much appreciated. Before I knew it, it was time to leave, and Ron advised me to make my departure as brief and low-key as possible. While Jodie played in her room, we unloaded the car and stacked the cases in the hall. When we were finished, I stood there uncertainly, wondering if I should just slip out.
"I'll fetch her," Betty said, sensing my indecision. "It's important to say goodbye."
I waited with Ron while Betty disappeared upstairs.
A child's voice erupted in the playroom, followed by the soothing tone of the teacher.
"Try not to worry," Ron said. "Really, she'll be fine."
Betty appeared on the landing, holding Jodie's hand. And as they descended, they counted down the steps together, just as we had at home.
11, 12, 13,
Jodie hesitated.
14,
I offered.
"That's right, Kathy, but let Betty do it. It's her job now."
I couldn't help but smile.
"I'm going now, Jodie. Will you give me a hug goodbye?"
She rolled her eyes, then held out her arms sullenly, waiting for me to come to her. I walked over, bent down and put my arms around her. She was stiff and unwilling, but then as I moved to pull away, I suddenly felt her arms tighten round my waist. Her head pressed against my stomach. I stroked her hair and blinked back my tears. This would be the last time I hugged her like this. I knew that. I tried to put everything I could into that last embrace. How much I cared for her, how I hoped that she would get better, and how sorry I was that I hadn't been able to help her in the way she needed. She'd been the most testing of all the children I'd fostered, and yet that had brought a bond of such closeness that it was difficult to let go, even though I knew it was for the best. After a few moments, I eased her away and drew back.
"Okay, sweet. I'll be off now and leave you to unpack. I'll phone in a couple of days." "Where you going?"
she asked, frowning.
"Home, pet. I have to do the housework, then make Adrian, Lucy and Paula their dinner. You'll be busy too."
She moved towards Betty, looping her arm around her waist and snuggled into her side.
"Okay, Kathy. I understand. This is my home now, and Amy's. You go. Bye."
I glanced at Betty, then turned towards the door. Jodie was behind me, repeating her explanation to Amy.
"Betty looks after us now."
Ron opened the front door and I crossed the gravel towards the car. I didn't look back until I was in my seat. The three of them gave a little wave,
then disappeared inside.
Chapter 34. Progress. The house was quiet save for the intermittent ringing of the phone. I listened as the answer phone clicked in, then turned over and closed my eyes. Was it the same person or a number of different callers? It didn't matter. I'd deal with it in my own time. It was the day after Jody had left. I'd gone back to bed after seeing the children off to school, and although I didn't sleep, the enveloping warmth of the duvet safely embraced and cocooned me. Had she slept, I wondered, or had she been plagued by nocturnal demons? What was she doing now? It was mid-morning. Was she in the playroom, out for a walk, or finishing her unpacking? Was she happy, or had she been taken over by one of her characters? How was she engaging with the other children? That was my biggest concern. Would they be more tolerant, having had similar experiences to hers? Or would their anger and bitterness turn on the stranger in their midst? I feared for her, but I knew I had to let go. The phone rang again, and I snatched it up.
Kathy?
It was Jill. Sorry to disturb you, but I thought you'd want to know. The police have picked up Jody's parents and three of the granddads and uncles, and they're going to charge them. The Smiths have accused them of abusing their daughter, and the police have got evidence this time. My mind snapped into focus as I pulled myself up in the bed. The Smiths? You remember Jody's neighbours? They stopped their daughter Louise going round to play.
Yes, yes, I know, but I thought they wanted to give the parents a character reference.
They did until all this came out. DNA has identified Jody's father and others. The police raided the house and found thousands of photographs. It is a paedophile ring and it looks pretty widespread. I stared at the curtains with the floral pattern illuminated by the morning sun. The enormity of what was happening suddenly hit me. The burden of proof had at last swung in Jody's favour. There was a chance that she would get justice and that the vile people who had abused her would be punished.
Eileen wants to know if you'll give evidence. I said I was sure you would, and they'll need your log. I'll arrange to have it collected.
I was still staring straight ahead as the peonies on the curtains glowed fiery red.
Yes, of course, anything. Oh, thank goodness. Do they know when it started? Have they got any idea?
They're still investigating, but apparently some of the photos show Jody very young. I paused. 18 months, that's when her development stopped.
Yes, and there's some before that. I'll keep you posted.
I replaced the receiver and remained sitting up in bed. I thought of poor Louise Smith, who had suffered despite her parents having been warned because they'd failed to take action. How many others had had their lives ruined because Jody had been ignored? All those years she'd been on the at-risk register, supposedly receiving regular visits from social workers, yet no one had noticed anything untoward. I thought of Jody's parents and remembered something I'd been told during training on sexual abuse some years before. The speaker had said that paedophiles were harder to catch than other criminals because they didn't believe they were doing anything wrong, so they didn't act guilty. Heaving myself out of bed, I walked along the landing and into Jody's room. The emptiness was stark compared with the cluttered chaos of before. The room still smelled of Jody, that personal scent which individualizes us all, the most evocative reminder of an absent friend or relative. I stared at the bed, which hadn't been touched since she'd left. Dust motes hung in the shaft of sunlight. I stood silently, taking in the lingering presence of Jody, still palpable, as though at any moment she could have reached out and touched me. As I turned to leave, I caught sight of an envelope propped on the chest of drawers behind the door. Kathy was printed on the front, in what appeared to be Paula's handwriting. I picked it up and opened it. Inside was a sheet of lined paper torn from an exercise book.
Dear Kathy, Paula is writing this, as I don't know my words. It was kind of you to look after me, and I wish I could have stayed. I'm sorry for all the bad things I did. I can't help it. Something makes me. You are the only person who has looked after me and not got angry. I think you understand. I hope you forgive me. Adrian, Lucy and Paula are very lucky. When they have made me better, can I come and live with you? Will you be my new mummy? I don't want my old one. Love, Jodie.
She signed her name herself, and the rest of the page was filled with kisses in red crayon. I looked up, and my eyes brimmed. Somehow I had reached her. It made everything worthwhile. It helped to assuage some of my sense of failure. Yes, Jodie, of course I will. Whenever you're ready, pet. Epilogue. Initially, Jodie found the move very difficult. She had two full-time carers, Claire and Val, who were allocated solely to her, working in shifts. I wasn't told very much about her progress, as I no longer had an official role. I wasn't a relative or her carer, I was just a visitor. Nonetheless, I gathered that she had often been violent and disruptive, and had continued with roughly the same patterns of behaviour as during her last months with me. In those first few months, she would phone regularly. Claire or Val would make the call, we'd have a brief chat, and then they'd hand the phone over to Jodie. Usually she was calling to complain about Claire or Val because they weren't letting her do exactly as she wanted. I would listen patiently as that familiar voice shouted,
"I'm bleeding going to kick 'em!"
And then I'd try to reason with her, to get her to understand that her carer's requests were for her own good, just as mine had been. Although we were frequently in touch, Jodie rarely gave us any sign of affection. I could tell she felt rejected and upset about the move, and she made this clear every time we visited. As we prepared to leave, I would try to hug her, but instead of returning the affection, she would wallop me on the arm, or worse, stand sullen and silent. What we did during our visits varied depending on Jodie's mood. If she was reasonably stable, we might go bowling, or to the park, or some local site of interest, usually followed by lunch at Pizza Hut, which had become her favourite. If she was having a bad day, we'd stay in the house, playing in the home corner, with Jodie making dinner on the toy oven or remonstrating with her baby doll. But however hostile she'd been, she would always ask when our next visit was going to be and phone within the week. After about 6 months, she managed to say goodbye properly at the end of a visit without thumping me, and it felt like a breakthrough. We praised her immensely. Jodie never spoke of her feelings, except of the hatred she still felt for her father, so all we could do was to try and interpret the few clues she gave. She never told me she resented me or felt rejected. Equally, she never said she missed us or looked forward to seeing us. I felt that her finally being able to say goodbye was a good sign, as it suggested she was reconciled to being at High Oaks, if nothing else. During this time, there was some discussion about whether to start contact between Jodie and her brother and sister, who had been found an adoptive family. In the end, the decision was made to leave things as they were. Jodie hardly ever mentioned her siblings except during therapy, and the general feeling was that they weren't close, so it would be best to allow Ben and Chelsea to have a fresh start. In many respects, Jodie had lost her childhood, but they still had theirs, having been taken into care that much younger, and, it was thought, having escaped the kind of abuse Jodie had suffered. Jodie did make progress at High Oaks, but her therapy and recovery were hampered by her learning difficulties. A CAT scan revealed brain damage, which had probably been caused by repeated blows to the head when she was an infant. Perhaps as a result of this, there was little progress in Jodie's education, speech, or motor skills, even though her behaviour did show some improvement. Jodie put on a lot of weight at High Oaks, and quickly. She had been overweight when she had come to me,
but I had managed to stabilise it. At High Oaks, however, some of the children were anorexic, so the house policy was to allow the children to eat pretty much what they liked. Jodie, given a free rein, had two helpings of everything, and within months the rolls of fat had reappeared round her middle and thighs. In the months after Jodie left, the two court cases took place. The final care hearing and the criminal prosecution of the abusers. The care hearing came first and resulted in full care orders for Jodie, Ben and Chelsea, which in practice meant that they all remained where they were. During the care hearing, my logs were requested by the judge to be used as evidence, but I didn't have to attend in person. A few months later, the criminal case was heard. The crimes against Jodie weren't actually included in the charges, as there was felt to be insufficient evidence. Instead, Jodie's father and the other men were charged in respect of another child and the possession and making of indecent photographs. Again, I had no involvement in the court case, and I only found out the outcome from Jill. Jodie's father and two other men were found guilty on all charges. Jodie's mother and two other defendants were acquitted. The three convicted men were all given custodial sentences. Jodie had been on the at-risk register since birth, and by the time she was taken into care, she had more than 50 visits to casualty, with injuries including broken bones, burns, scalds and cuts. Jodie's social services file was apparently so large that it filled two suitcases. Jodie's case history was a catalogue of errors and a shameful indictment of the failings of the social services. For Jodie to have been on the at-risk register for 8 years was bad practice in itself. Children are placed on the register to allow social services to monitor and investigate. Either an investigation should take place, or social services should satisfy themselves that everything is in order, with the child then being removed from the register. In Jodie's case, neither course was followed. One reason for this appears to have been the high turnover of social workers. There had been over 20 involved in Jodie's case. It appears that Jodie's social workers had avoided making visits to the house, or had allowed themselves to be intimidated into not asking the proper questions. As a result of this intimidation, the family were frequently passed on to new social workers. As bad as this sounds, I did have some sympathy. The majority of social workers are women, and they are expected to visit violent households on their own. They are frequently attacked, but they hardly ever press charges because their job requires them to try to build a relationship with these parents. As a result, parents who know the system know that they can treat social workers with impunity. In this context, it's no wonder that some social workers avoid visiting aggressive families or accept unconvincing excuses. As the Brown family were passed from one weary social worker to the next, their file at social services quickly expanded. Social workers are plagued by paperwork. The file soon became prohibitively large, in that its sheer size meant that no one involved in the case seemed to have time to read the whole thing. If anyone had seen the overall picture, including all of Jodie's hospital visits, they would surely have acted sooner. However, Jodie's case isn't the first to be overlooked in this way, and sadly, I doubt it will be the last. Today, 3 years on, Jodie continues to make slow, limited progress. Much of her anxiety has gone, and she's probably as happy as she's ever going to be. The intensive therapy has helped her to bring the various parts of her personality together, and Amy and Reg now make only rare appearances. She feels safe at High Oaks and knows that the protection of those identities is no longer needed. Jodie is now in a special school. As she has grown older, her learning difficulties have become increasingly apparent. When I take her out, people now treat her like a disabled child, going out of their way to speak to her, behaving with exaggerated kindness. She's very overweight, and this makes her even more cumbersome and accident-prone. Her delayed development and poor speech are also obvious, and every year she falls further behind her peers. At some point, perhaps quite soon, she will reach her ceiling in terms of what she can learn, and her disability will become even more pronounced in contrast to her peers.
She rarely mentions her parents now, other than in the context of her ongoing therapy. She does exchange birthday and Christmas cards with Ben and Chelsea, and she has spoken to them on the phone once. This phone call, however, was not a success, and is unlikely to be repeated, as she became very confused and hostile. Much of what happened to Jody remains deeply buried, and will probably stay buried indefinitely. Only time will tell. The children and I still visit Jody, making the return trip of 200 miles every 4 to 6 weeks. We also speak to her on the phone most weeks. On our most recent visit, Paula and I took her to a steakhouse, as a change from pizza, and while we waited for our order to arrive, Jody suddenly looked directly at Paula and said,
"I like your top. It's very pretty."
We were delighted. It was the first compliment we'd ever heard Jody offer, and it suggested real progress, as it showed the beginnings of empathy. Jody had complimented Paula because she wanted to make her feel good and because she wanted us to like her. I still find it hard to understand what happened to Jody. I can somehow accept that there are parents who neglect their children through drink or drugs or mental illness, and whose cruelty is a side effect of other problems. But the dreadful abyss that Jody lived in is a mystery of such darkness and evil that it beggars belief. When I look at my own children, and thank goodness the majority of children, who are loved and cared for and nurtured, it is hard to comprehend the mindset of parents who seem to care nothing for their child and do not simply neglect her, but actively set about destroying her for their own perverted gratification. Jody is a damaged child. She has been vandalized. Her mental processes and her emotions have been destroyed. I doubt if she will ever recover sufficiently to lead a normal life, and she will never get the pleasure from life that should have been hers. She has been condemned to an endless punishment by the very people who should have cared for her the most. To me, that is the worst crime imaginable. I still visit Jody at High Oaks. Many of the children who were there when Jody arrived have now left, having recovered enough to move on to long-term foster families. Whether Jody will ever be able to do the same remains to be seen. But if ever she can, and I'm not too old, my offer stands. And I am still fostering. There's always another child out there who needs help. You've been listening to Damaged by Kathy Glass, read by Danica Fairman for Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.